It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Change, revolution, upheaval, breakthrough, some synonyms for innovation. How do each of us define innovation? Or by trying to define it, do we put artificial constraints on it? These are among the things that we're discussing with our guests, Bart Rocco, superintendent of the Elizabeth Forward School District. Mr. Rocco, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. Nice being here.
Also with us is Billy Rondinelli. She's superintendent of the South Fayette School District. And Billy Rondinelli, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. We're very glad to be here today.
And by phone, Dr. Lynn Shrum, Dean of West Virginia University's College of Education and Human Services and co-chair of the Remake Learning Council. Dean Shrum, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be part of this.
And I am going to throw the first question out to you. How do you define innovation?
As a lifetime educator, I guess I have to put it in the context of education. And to me, someone is innovative when they try new things, assess them, figure out what's working, and keep on trying new things.
Last week, the Pittsburgh area was recognized at the Tribeca Disruptive Innovation Awards in New York. The only city to get this award usually goes to an individual. So does that say something about the cooperative nature of schools, support organizations, after-school programs, cultural institutions, et cetera, in this region? I'm going to toss that up to anybody. Bart, you look like you want to answer.
Yeah, I can answer that. I would say that it's interesting, the word disruption, maybe 20 years ago, was not a word or term that we would use in public education. But I think today, because of this idea of change and the importance of change, that disruption is part of what we do. If you think about it, schools for hundreds of years have never really changed. If you look at a classroom back in the 1900s, it was pretty much the same classroom as it is today. So what you're seeing in a lot of classrooms across the country, and especially in our region, I know at South Fayette and at Elizabeth Forward, we're doing some really creative things with environment to engage kids in creative and new environments, and then coupling that with new and interesting curriculum to engage children. And I think that's really a critical piece of this disruption. It's taking away from that silo type of learning that's been going on.
And Billy Rondinelli, I'll let you weigh in on this.
Well, the Tribeca Disruptive Innovation Awards really celebrate those ideas that have broken the mold, so to speak. And so it's creating a significant impact around change processes, and around new innovations and development. So I think it's perfectly appropriate because I know the Grable Foundation, the Sprout Fund, all of the foundations in our area have really been working very hard to create this positive impact and change.
Innovation isn't limited to our schools when it comes to helping children learn. Lynn, for example, the Remake Learning Kids Plus Creativity Network, what can you tell us about that?
Right. And I'd just like to add, as a relatively newcomer to this area, I've been incredibly impressed with the innovation as a mantra for what's going on, but also the collaboration. And I think that's what the Remake Learning represents. It's a focus to say, let's find out who's doing what interesting things. So rather than every person reinventing the wheel on his or her own, we learn from each other. We share best practices, and we try very hard to work together, which is not always the case, may I say. So the Remake Learning Kids Plus Creativity Network and a new focus we're having on a council to support that is really designed to bring that all the players to the table to share and to grow, see what we can do together that we can't do singularly.
Bart and Billy, how much of a direct impact do the libraries, museums, other institutions have on schools, particularly in terms of innovation, or is it more of a complementary component?
The museums and the libraries have made a significant impact on the South Fayette School District, as well as the foundations, because they've been catalysts for innovation and catalysts for change in our district. The one thing I would like to share is, for example, each year in the South Fayette School District, we conduct annual operational plan meetings. And this past year, we went through the Arts Education Collaborative. We went to the Children's Museum and looked at their make shop. And so as we looked at that make shop, we were able to redesign a space in our K-2 building, design and build a make shop for our earliest learners. That has really been a huge, significant change for hands-on activities that really focus on STEAM-related events with our students. And it's not just an event, but it's a happening. It's an inspirational look at how we are teaching young children.
Bart Rocker?
Yeah, at Elizabeth Forward, we've really recreated some spaces with the help of going out and looking at different spaces. And I think one of the things about educators in general is we sort of stay within the confines of our own communities and areas. And to really understand the world, you've got to go beyond those walls. Traveled to Chicago several years ago to look at the U-Media Library in Chicago. And we came back and basically said, we want to recreate our environment at our high school to model that. And with the help of Greg Baer and the Grable Foundation, and of course developing a team through the Sprout Fund, Kathy Lewis Long and some of the folks there that have helped us, we put together a U-Media space that is phenomenal space for young people at our high school. And it really has changed the culture of that school, because it's not just about the library space or that learning that occurs. It's the children learning these different medias. And I think if my team wouldn't have gone out to view that space, we would have really been at a loss because we didn't know what to do. So that's one thing. The other thing I think is important, my experience working with Carnegie Mellon University, we have a partnership with Carnegie Mellon in several different areas. But I first met Don Marinelli, who is now was the retired executive director at Carnegie Mellon. And Don said, if you could paint the walls of your classrooms, I could help you. And that's really been our story. You know, we're now changing the environment by painting the walls. And I know that sounds crazy, but if you think about museums for the most part, children have really looked forward to it when they were going, you know, if you took one field trip a year, it was to the museum. And what we need to do is we need to make our schools museums. We need to make them places where kids want to go, where they feel engaged, where the environment is innovative and creative and new. That engages them in learning. And I think that's really important from an educator standpoint, that, you know, you can create those spaces. It doesn't cost a lot of money. It's as much as some paint in the walls or doing some different things to keep those environments fresh for young people. So, but I think going out has helped, and I think also we can create those spaces.
I'd just like to throw something in, if I might. As someone who has studied innovation in education for the last 25 years, I'd say what I'm hearing is very exciting from both of you, and what I see in a variety of places is exactly that. We are seeing this all over the country, perhaps more concentrated in our Pittsburgh area, but absolutely the schools that are making a difference in students' achievement and their staying in school really are the ones who are interested in students' perceptions, students' engagement, and being willing to try new things. I guess that gets back to the definition of innovation.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and we're discussing innovative approaches to teaching in the Pittsburgh area. Let's listen to one such example. When you think back to your school days, or even if you're still in school, you likely sat through numerous lectures, then went home and worked on math or science problems on your own. WESA's Deanna Garcia reports some teachers are turning the traditional notion of schoolwork and homework on its head and flipping the classroom, including one teacher at Chartiers Valley High School.
As the school bell rings, signaling the start of Susan Marino's junior physics class, the students get settled into their seats, not to hear a lecture about physics, but to work out problems in class. That's because Marino has already given them their lecture at home the night before.
And then when they come into class, what used to be their homework assignment, which is in physics, it's mostly problems, they used to go home and do those on their own at home. Now when they come in to school, they get into groups and they're able to work on what used to be their homework, but now it's in classwork.
This is what's called a flipped classroom. Marino uses what's called a smart pen that records her voice and what she's writing on a special piece of paper. The students then access what's called a pencast at home. It's a PDF file on which they see what she wrote and hear what she's saying.
The way this is designed now, I'm able to help them. They don't have that homework, take-home homework anymore. They come into class and they're working with me.
The students themselves, overall, say they like the flipped classroom, though some say it does take some getting used to. Students like Nick Kalla.
I think it's just a different twist on. I kind of like it, and sometimes it has its ups and downs.
Marino has been teaching for more than 20 years and has been flipping her classroom for 3. She says she's seen numerous benefits.
Some students that normally would have dropped my class because they just could not do the work, they're now able to take the class. Some of the kids will say, I have to watch those two or three times. And I see more students are succeeding in the, and it's a college-level physics course.
Not everyone is singing the praises of the flipped classroom. James Orchowski has a strong opinion when asked how he likes it, though judging by the snickering of his fellow group members, it's not clear if he's being serious or not.
Honestly, I hate it. It's just a disgrace. Like, I mean, it's the truth. I'm sure every other kid in this classroom feels that way about it.
If any other students feel that way, none were as outspoken about it. Other students, such as Ashley Riley, see it differently.
It's actually beneficial because, I mean, she's not asking much from us. She's just saying, watch a video. They're usually under 10 minutes. So, I mean, just watch the video and you'll be on top of things.
The videos can be up to about 20 minutes long and they don't expire. The flipped classroom model was developed in the 1990s, and as technology has improved, so has the delivery. As a longtime educator, Marino says the Pencasts have made a definite impact.
As we've changed through the years, different things came about, and I would be like, wow, you can't get any better than this, like with the overhead projector, and then the LCD, and then, you know, I would teach from the back of the classroom using my air slate, and I'd think, oh, this changed everything. Nothing changed it for the students, for the instruction of the students, as much as flipping the classroom.
But not all classrooms and schools can take advantage. Students at Chartiers Valley High School have access that many larger districts do not. Marino says each student is supplied with one school-issued laptop they can take home each night.
Without that, I don't think I could have done this because I don't think all students would have had access.
And Marino says not all classes are really built for the flipped classroom model.
For my course, it doesn't fit every course, but for my course, I can't think of a better way of teaching the class.
Student Zach Davies wants to be an engineer and says physics is a passion of his. He says he likes the concept of the flipped classroom, but agrees with Marino that it's not suited for every subject.
In a history class, there really wouldn't be a point to it other than read your book.
Marino says she's pleased with this model of teaching.
No going back. I can't imagine.
The flipped classroom trend is growing across the nation, and Marino says she's seen interest grow among her colleagues as well. I'm Deanna Garcia, 90.5 WESA News.
We heard Indiana Garcia's report about the flipped classroom approach in a physics high school class in the Chartiers Valley School District. So first, for our two superintendents in general, what are your thoughts on flipped classrooms? Does this approach make teaching more effective or does it depend on the subject matter? Billy.
I was just going to say that I think that the focus here is on innovation and learning. And I think there are many different ways to go about that. And the flipped classroom is certainly one way. One concern that some people have is because it does create a little bit of a digital divide. And I think one thing that we heard very clearly is that without having a one-to-one situation, that it would be very difficult to enact this. Certainly, teachers have communicated with students in a variety of ways for a very long period of time. And I think this particular teacher that we just heard, she's done an excellent job of embracing innovation and embracing change, and she's made it work for her and her students, and that's to be commended.
And Billy Rondinelli is superintendent of the South Fayette School District, and Bart Rocco, superintendent of the Elizabeth Forward School District. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, that learning is everywhere all the time. It's ubiquitous. And I think that the flipped classroom concept is just a definition of that. Now, if children want to learn, if they have an iPhone, if they have an iPad, I mean, learning is everywhere. Now, in the Elizabeth Forward School District, we have a K-12 iPad initiative. Every child gets an iPad K-12. And it is about, certainly, the technology and using the technology, but it's about the learning that goes with it. So it's, you know, we use that technology to gauge and engage children. One of the examples I liked, you know, she was talking about having this some of the videotaping or of the lesson. We have an app right now that the teachers are using called Erasma, where the teacher has a worksheet. She records herself going over that worksheet. When the children get home, they can hover their iPad over the worksheet, and the teacher's face appears, and she's actually teaching the students the problem. And so I think that's an amazing thing that the children now, it's not just, you know, getting that at one time. It's relearning material, and that's sort of something that we've been working on. in the industry, and there are about 100,000 educational apps that are on the market today. That's just one. So if you think in the next couple of years what some of these engagements, some of these apps will be for young people and for educators to use. But again, I think the real important thing here is that we're no longer, the teachers in the classroom are no longer the sage on the stage. You know, we're the guide on the side, and we have to sort of work with technology and our students in a completely different way than we did maybe, you know, several years ago.
No longer the sage on the stage, the guide from the side.
That's
interesting.
Right.
Well, Lynn Shrum, Dean of West Virginia University School of Education, do you address such concepts as the flipped classroom in preparing future teachers?
I'm so glad you asked that. And I would like to also add that I really support the notion that learning can take place in multiple ways, and it really reaches learners as they need to have information, and it challenges them in good ways. They can repeat the lesson by going online to look at it. But we are definitely preparing future teachers to understand the power of the technology, the way it can change the teaching and learning process, and moving them away from a one-answer solution. So there's not, we want to get them to think about teaching and learning so that there are multiple answers. So kids are challenged to investigate, to be curious about a lot of different ways to answer any particular question. We have lots of rooms where they have smart boards, electronic whiteboards, and other kinds of technologies, but we focus on the pedagogy that it takes to teach that. Our students don't leave our classrooms and get to the schools until they are really ready to think in multiple ways about what does it mean today to teach and prepare the future leaders for their future.
Is the flipped classroom approach in some ways too easy because students don't end up taking work home and have to think for themselves? In this case, are they less reliant on their own brains and maybe a little dependent on collaborating with others?
From my perspective, you know, children still need to be independent learners. I mean, as I said earlier on, you have all the technology in the world, but children are still going to have to be engaged in some way and want to learn the material that's out there. I think that's really critically important. If they're not, and we're all part of that team, the teacher, the parent, the administrators, the student, you know, we all have to play into that role as educators in a technology-centered-driven, you know, setting.
Coming up on this Life of Learning special on innovation, when is disruption a good thing? That's next. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As part of 90.5 WESA's Life of Learning initiative, we're discussing innovative approaches to better engage students and increase achievement. Our guests are Bart Rocco, superintendent of the Elizabeth Forward School District, Billy Rondinelli, superintendent of the South Fayette School District, and by phone, Dr. Lynn Shrum, dean of West Virginia University's College of Education and Human Services. Earlier in the program, we mentioned the Disruptive Innovation Award. Is the current education system as a whole resistant to disruption or change? Let's start with Lynn Shrum.
I have to be honest, education moves slowly, I think in academia maybe even more slowly than anywhere else, and that's for good reasons as well as perhaps a little bit of resistance. But I'm seeing some real power in people recognizing the positive aspect of disruption, of change. I think we're starting to see some changes where people who are trying innovative things are rewarded for it rather than punished. And to me, it falls back to school leaders, and they have to be willing, and we have to be willing to encourage and support people trying and perhaps failing. I think many educators think that failing is not a good thing, but how are we ever going to move forward if we don't give things a try? So we need to be risk takers.
And Bart Rocco, are you sensing just in general in our education system as it is currently configured that there is a resistance to disruption or change?
I think a lot of what's driving public education today is standardized testing. And I think schools are driven because they're being ranked and teachers now are going to be evaluated by that. And I think a lot of schools are reluctant to make that leap And as Lynn said, I agree 100%, and that's my mantra, you know, that failure is part of what we do. But we're so hinged upon this idea that standardized tests are that important. And how do you mesh this innovation and creativity concept in the construct of that standardized test platform? And what worries me is we're relying on those children to just have one-word answers, and we're losing a lot of the creativity in the world. And even one of the things we did at our middle school, we created a Dream Factory makerspace where kids are out there programming, creating and building things using 3D technologies and coupling with art. And again, that's where you really see kids engaged in school and learning, and they're not driven by that one single answer. So I think schools are, I think they're ready to make the change. I think what's holding us back is that ranking that we're receiving, and now it's being driven by how teachers and administrators are going to be evaluated.
Billy Rondinelli, is standardized testing holding us back, as Bart Rocco says?
We miss many days of school just for testing. And so it's a time constraint. That's one definite hamper that we have. But what I would say is that embedding creativity and innovation requires different processes than simply the testing formulas that you have. And you want students to be creative thinkers. You want them to be problem solvers. You want them to have project-based learning experiences and inquiry-based learning experiences. And so, you know, something that is unique that South Fayette has done is that we have created these after-school incubator projects for students. And so we have App Lab projects where we have students that actually presented at Pepperdine University. They created an app in conjunction with Carnegie Mellon University, and we've reached out to other schools. We've beta tested it within our own district, and it's basically a math flashcard project. So the app that they've designed actually does help students with math that they may succeed on their standardized test. But that wasn't the intent of the design. It was really that problem solving and engaging in what the real world solution might be to help students better understand mathematics.
I just so applaud these two examples, and we are preparing educators to take their place, and they're not excited about teaching to the test. They're excited about the kind of educational opportunities that we've just heard described. So I applaud it. We need more schools like that.
Do you ever get pushback from parents when it comes to trying new approaches? People that say, adults that come to you and say, don't experiment on my kids? Bart, you're smiling.
Yeah, well, obviously a few parents. I think what they have to see, though, is as I do, I visit a lot of classrooms. You go and you see the engagement of young people, and I think that really turns them around. I think the other thing is, you know, for years and years and years, school's curriculum has been taught in silos. You know, we teach math in a silo. We teach English in a silo. You know, we teach science in a silo. We don't show young people how those things integrate. I look at some of the work by Tony Wagner, you know, problem-solving, critical thinking, collaboration and leadership, adaptability. Those kinds of things need to be taught in our schools because we know that those are the skills they need. So kids, young people need to see the relationship between how all those different disciplines work together. I know that's for certain what we're trying to do at Elizabeth Forward School District. I know Billy does that at South Fayette with some of the projects that she works on as well. We also need to teach children curiosity and imagination.
And Bart, last year your school district was inducted into the League of Innovative Schools, the first district in PA to be so honored. Billy Rondinelli, your district was inducted. In addition to this accolade, how will this help your districts be even more innovative? And aside from the national acknowledgement, how will this benefit your students, Billy?
Well, it's already started to benefit. First of all, the networking is incredible. Engaging with students and teachers and superintendents from across the country. For example, on our most recent visit to Tucson, Arizona, that's where we, as a first-time district, were onboarded. And I really want to give credit to the Elizabeth Forward School District because they really helped us through this application process and in looking at some of the innovative things that they've done. We certainly had the qualifications, but they really helped to guide us. And so just collaborating. We visited Sunnyside School District. It's a school district where they did a rollout of one-to-one for approximately 18,000 students. Looking at the innovation in their classrooms and the learning gave us some ideas about things that we can certainly do here. But that's not to say that we don't have ideas to share as part of the league as well. So, for example, we have a computational thinking strand at South Fayette that's going on, and we're in collaboration with MIT. And that is a national research project, but it's also teaching our students from kindergarten through 12th grade, what does computational thinking mean? So it's about coming together as this league, as what do we have to offer, but also what can we share with others.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer on 90.5 WESA. And Lynn, how do we make sure that technology is a tool and not a crutch when it comes to innovative approaches?
That's a great question, Paul. As someone who's studied technology for a very long time and its potential to change teaching and learning, I have to say that I've never seen it used as a crutch except in cases when people were trying to teach to the test. But otherwise, once teachers understand the power of engaging students, of getting them asking difficult questions, and again, where there's no one answer, but where there are lots of complexities, then we move away from those very simplistic things that are boring. And so what I've seen is teachers trying their best to think of interesting, challenging problems. I would also go back to say that those kinds of challenging problems that engage technology, not all the time, but sometimes, they are the ones that take a long time, 3 or 4 weeks perhaps, project-based learning kinds of things. And those don't solve the problems that we see on the tests, fill-in-the-bubble kind of things.
You know, I don't think it's about the technology so much as I think it's the learning. It's sort of what Lynn talked about, you know, the pedagogy, how we're instructing it, how our classrooms are different now than they were years ago. And, you know, but I think certainly having that technology only accentuates what our children can learn. If I would say to you, if you put an iPad in the hand of a child right now and you ask him to look something up, you know, obviously, what is he going to do? He's going to Google it. And today, does that mean that he doesn't know that concept? No, it's just that he knows. Maybe he uses Bing.
Does anybody use dictionaries
anymore? I don't
know.
Well, you know,
or encyclopedias.
Well, encyclopedias, they're old. I mean, if you think about it, if you had an encyclopedia that was, you had it produced last year, it's all out of date already. So, you know, instantaneous information.
Well, I think we have to remember that good learning is good learning. And I would say that young people right now, this is their world. You know, if you look at the book written by Mick McManus and Maya and Luma, The Trillions, all of the technology is going to continuously change for us. And so we can't hardly keep up with it. We have to learn to manage. What is it we need to know? What problem do we have to solve? It's about inquiry-based learning. It's about persevering and trying to find a solution.
Technology is part of the name of a school in the Pittsburgh Public School District. Let's listen to Liz Reed's report on how science and technology-centered learning is part of every class from biology to music.
Dream, discover, design. That's the motto of Pittsburgh Science and Technology Academy in Oakland, a public magnet school focused on the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Essentially, the entire middle and high school shines a spotlight on innovation.
The whole idea is tinkering. So we play, we tinker, we fail, we figure out what we did wrong, and we work again at, you know, try to see what we did wrong.
That's Anne Gullipudi, who teaches physics and computer science at SciTech, the colloquial name for the school.
The process is not so much as what we created, but the process is what did we discover along the way.
Gullipudi is an engineer by trade, but she left private industry, went back to school, and took a teacher. Her classes fall into the computers and connections concentration at SciTech. Students like Victor Kavuva choose one of 4 different concentrations at the end of their 9th grade year.
There's FNF, which is form and function. There's CNC, which is computers and connections. There's ENE, which is environment and energy, which is right next door. And then there's B&B, which is body and behavior.
Kavuva lives in Stanton Heights, and he's taking Dr. Edwina Conchington's 11th grade bioinformatics class as part of the body and behavior concentration. Right now, students are learning about the immune system and are evaluating the results of an experiment with simulated antigens like bacteria and viruses and antibodies, the proteins in your body that help fight antigens. SciTech teachers say this hands-on approach to education is a cornerstone of the school's curriculum, and whether it's biology, English, music, or art, science and technology are always at the center of learning. Matt Ferranti teaches music technology and says that unlike some other schools where he's taught, he never feels peripheral at SciTech.
I always feel like I'm just as much a part of the curriculum, of the pulse of the school as any other class. And sometimes it's just like, okay, well, it's testing time, so let's shut down all the music classes. Like that, something like that's never going to happen here.
In fact, Ferranti gets 2 full hours with his middle schoolers nearly every day and 80 minutes with high schoolers. Longer class periods and science and technology-centered learning aren't the only things that make SciTech unique. Because SciTech is a magnet school, kids come from all over Pittsburgh. Unlike a neighborhood school, the students have actively chosen to be there. And as a result, says Ferranti,
and the kids seem to be really interested in learning, so I don't really have to work too hard to get them ready to go. It's just like, here we go, we're going to do this. And they're like, okay, let's do it.
That enthusiasm for learning is evidenced by the results of a less than innovative approach to measuring student achievement, standardized test scores. According to last year's Keystone exam data, nearly three-quarters of high schoolers at SciTech achieved proficiency in algebra by the end of their junior year, and more than 80% were proficient in literature. That's compared to a district-wide average of 51% in algebra and 64% in literature. That makes SciTech one of the highest-scoring schools in the district. In fact, its test scores are rivaled only by other magnet schools. It's hard to say whether these higher test scores are a consequence of a student population that has self-selected to succeed, or whether there's something about SciTech's approach that's actually helping these kids succeed. Likely, it's a little bit of both. What is clear is that most SciTech students see their high school experience as the foundation of a career, something that many teens take for granted. Back in Dr. Kinchinkton's 11th grade biology class, Imani Walker of Sheridan says as soon as she heard about SciTech, she knew she wanted to go there. She says it's all part of a plan she's been working on since she was a kindergartner.
I want to be a forensic anthropologist, and I would love to go to Cedar Crest.
What does that mean?
A forensic anthropologist basically studies the human body and its culture and the way it interacts with people and things like that.
But it's not all sunshine and rainbows at SciTech. The school is just 5 years old, so there's not much data on graduation rates or student success after high school. And like many schools in Pittsburgh and across Pennsylvania, there is a distinct achievement gap between Black and white students. Last year, less than a third of the African-American students at SciTech achieved proficiency in biology on the Keystone exam, compared to nearly three-quarters of white students. I'm Liz Reed, 90.5 WESA News.
Technology can be very useful in terms of innovation when it comes to teaching and learning, but creativity doesn't have to be limited to technology, does it, folks? It can be just a different way of thinking, right? A different approach to getting kids engaged? Bart?
Yeah, I would say so. And again, I think the certainly one of the things we instituted a couple years ago, Elizabeth Ford, was a gaming curriculum, actually teaching children how to create and build apps for games. We've done a little bit of work with a couple of nonprofits in the area with once our children have matriculated through all the coursework. And I think kids need to, they're using that technology to be creative and do different things. I think that's really what we need to do. We need to take the technology that they're using and create and build things. And again, what concerns me is it's not just about that standardized test, but it's also about that collaborations, that leadership, the ability to analyze and be curious and be innovative in the way they approach things.
So. And Billy Rondinelli, what is your take on this?
I was just going to say it's really about creating and sustaining a culture. It's about a culture of learning and embedding it. We have a new building, a 3-4-5 configuration, and we have STEAM studios in that building. And when you look at the students working on their e-textile projects, and when you look at the students as they are engaging in growing with the Sprout Fund, we were able to do some hydroponic gardens. And so they're growing, and they're learning about root systems and plants and so forth through these hydroponic tables that we have. When you see students engaged in these activities, it's about a mindset of continuous enhancement, continuous learning, and about sustaining that culture.
And Lynn Schrum, before we go to break, I'll let you chime in.
Just wanted to add one piece, and that's let's not think about technology as doing what we've always done in a little bit faster or glitzier way. Also the opportunity to look at, as Billy said, the ways to change things, to challenge people to think of learning in an exciting and innovative way and to learn new things, deeper things.
Coming up on this Life of Learning special on innovation, blending the arts with sciences. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're discussing innovative approaches to getting students excited about learning with Bart Rocco, superintendent of the Elizabeth Forward School District, Billy Rondinelli, superintendent of the South Fayette School District, and by phone, Dr. Lynn Shrum, dean of West Virginia University's College of Education and Human Services and co-chair of the Remake Learning Council. Okay, folks, so most people know of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and some STEAM, with arts representing the A. We touched a little bit on this in the previous segment. So as to make sure that the arts are not ignored when it comes to education, STEAM has been created. But how innovative can we get in blending slash relating the arts with the sciences?
The arts are essential to learning. I'm absolutely passionate about this. Traditionally, schools have separated out arts and sciences, theory and practice, and those are really artificial divisions. You really have to think about how the real world works. So, for example, if you look at those who are architects, they are truly artists. They're designers, craftsmen. They deal in aesthetics, perspective, mathematical precision. And so it's a part of all that we do. The arts really are a foundation and provide a foundation for every field that we're in. Too often people think of the arts as that's a musical or that's a play, but when you think about all of the functions that go into those aspects, it really centers around STEAM-focused activities.
Lynn, why has arts taken a back seat in many cases to other aspects of curricula and been de-emphasized?
It's a great question. I think as money becomes tight, we begin to limit extra things. And the other push on that is as testing becomes more important, there isn't time in the curriculum for things that aren't tested that don't officially count. So we've seen music, art, PE, tragically being eliminated from our educational experiences for kids. We're working with the College of Creative Arts here to try and develop a specialty for elementary teachers to specialize in integrating arts into the elementary curriculum because it's often taken out. I couldn't agree more that it's essential to life. It's not just what we have to be able to answer on questions, but we have to enjoy our life too, and the arts are essential for that. So we strive to make sure that people understand the integration of those things.
And Bart, even though budgets are tight, can we really afford, when it comes to educating our children, to think of the arts as a quote-unquote extra thing?
Absolutely not. Again, I'm torn on this acronym of STEAM and STEM. I think that it's learning, and the problem is at first it was STEM, and then the arts community got upset, so they added the A, and now it's involved. And I always say, well, how about the social sciences? Mm-hmm. How about reading? And one of the things that I think we have to remember that all children come to this experience of learning at different levels and at different places in their lives. And some are really artistic and have this flair, and they don't need technology to be artistic. They have a talent. I mean, a lot of people go to the theater, they go to the movies, they sing, they hear that. They don't necessarily need a specific technology to be talented in that. But certainly, the industry, business, is driving a lot of what's going on in public education with these money that's behind right now is in the STEAM and the STEM grants. That's where the National Science Foundation, a lot of the big government agencies, are pushing this technology because it's going to help jobs.
I'm going to be very interested to see what all of you think about what Deanna Garcia is going to tell us about here as she takes us on a visit to an area school where one classroom is trying to combine literature and the arts with science and technology. Let's listen.
A diorama on steroids. That's how Springdale Junior and Senior High Gifted Support Coordinator Susan Mellon describes what she's doing in the classroom. The students she's working with take poetry and combine it with computer technology and engineering. So, you have STEM, you throw in the arts, you get STEAM. Mellon's students take a short published poem and bring it to life using robotic components.
Kids tend to be a little intimidated by poetry, so I thought that this would take something they're intimidated and don't like and make it fun.
Mellon's students are working in small groups, putting the finishing touches on their projects. They craft the dioramas, and with a hummingbird robotics kit, they can program movements in the diorama to go along with the poem. The hummingbird kits include a circuit board that connects to a computer. It controls movements and lights. If you listen carefully, you can hear the robotic component moving in parts of this poem.
I held a jewel in my fingers and went to sleep. The day was warm and winds were prosy, I said, "Spokeep." I woke and chid my honest fingers. The gem was gone, and now an amethyst remembrance is all I own.
That was Odessa Rohr reading I Held a Jewel in My Fingers by Emily Dickinson. The group of girls who were assigned the poem built a diorama featuring a girl in a bed. It includes lights, and the robotic component makes the girl sit up and lay back down. The lights are also computer-controlled and shine different colors on command. It helps to teach the students some basic programming, but Mellon says it also helps them learn poetry.
Repetition in poetry increases comprehension of the poem. So by building, you get this natural repetition. They'll have recorded the poem, so it'll run well. Their robotic actions highlight what's going on in the poem. And so even by, that's another form of repetition, you know, someone's recording the poem, but they have to keep referring back to it to make it kind of come alive.
And students like Alicia Matthews seem to get that. Her group is working on the poem She Sweeps with Many Colored Brooms, also by Emily Dickinson.
The whole point of this as well is that we have to read the poem many times to understand it, so repetition helps get it stuck in our head so we can symbolize it and turn it to life.
Mellon says the hope is that these projects will stay with the students beyond the time it takes to make the poetry theaters.
And I just hope the message sticks, like, oh, I really understood my poem. So when they see a little bit of poetry on an SAT or, you know, a PSSA, they're like, I know if I read this a couple of times, I'll get this question. As I hope that's what they'll get from this experience.
There's another underlying effort at play, though. Mellon is part of a National Science Foundation study to identify early STEM talent that may not otherwise be noticed and fostered.
When the parents have more resources, they're down at STEM, doing this summer class, that summer class. So somebody there is going to maybe be able to recognize that early STEM talent.
But for families who can't send their kids to summer camps and classes, that early talent could be lost. Mellon says some students in the district who have excelled in STEM have taught fellow students at after-school programs, and efforts are underway to expand that type of program. The Hummingbird Robotics Kit used in Mellon's room is a spin-off product of Carnegie Mellon University's Create Lab and is sold by Bird Brain Technologies out of Pittsburgh. Use of the kits, along with other technologies, is spreading in schools across the U.S. This year, hundreds of Finch robots from Bird Brain Technologies are being loaned to schools to help students learn computer programming. I'm Deanna Garcia, 90.5 WESA News.
Very interesting. So, what about what we just heard? Bart Rocco, Billy Rondinelli, Lynn Shrum, this whole idea of the use of subject matter from one course or class and relating it to another. Billy.
Oh, I think it's generating a lot of student interest. For example, we have taken an art class, a traditional art class in our middle school, and we worked with Create Lab on one of the robotics projects, and so we integrated the science and technology. Our art teacher had a Beatles project that she had worked on, and so in my...
Beatles, B-E-A-T?
Beatles like John Paul, George, and Ringo.
Okay.
And so I had the vision that each pod of students would create these John Paul, George, and Ringos, and that they would program them so that they would move. Well, our students were much more creative than I had originally envisioned, and we had penguins, robots, we had all kind of beetles, but we also had Sesame Street characters and so on, and so that was really one of the first projects that we did in our district where we integrated the science into the traditional art class. But since that time, we started the Scratch animation project as an after-school club and activity. We had hoped to get about 15 students. At first crack, we had about 65. And so we had to increase. The students were running an Inspire series. We had people from Shell Games there talking about how you can use in video gaming and gaming. And Bart's school district has really done an outstanding job with that. But how you use these technologies. We've really started to talk about our studios as innovation studios because literacy is the underpinning for everything that we do. But nevertheless, we do want to focus on all of these after-school clubs, activities, everything that we can do to engage our students really in the process of learning.
And I think we're embedding that too. You know, at Elizabeth Ford, we have our, you know, every child in our middle school, 6th through 8th grade, are, you know, learning Scratch and program. We think that's important. Anything that you can do to engage a child in learning something new, use it. And if it's that technology, if it's that child reading Emily Dickinson and performing it, or reading Shakespeare and performing, or going to a play to see it, in maybe making a video about it. Anything that you can to engage them in that aspect of learning, I think, is important.
So can they go off and do this stuff on their own, or do you have to approve it? You know, at what point do their approaches have to be approved?
I think it has to. Children have ideas about what they want to do, and I think our job as educators is to guide them and say, hey, this is a good idea, try this, or maybe you want to try this idea. Point them into resources or areas that they might think might work, and that would certainly help move that learning on and into a different area.
We certainly look for where we can embed these opportunities into our curriculum.
Yeah,
make no
absolutely.
Mistake about that. You know, how does it fit? So, for example, if we're doing e-cyber surgeon, how does that fit into our biology curriculum or our high school sciences? And so our students are engaging and learning and creating games and different types of presentations and so forth on their own all the time. They're using GarageBand. They're using all different types of media to create and learn 24/7.
And Lynn, I hear you chomping at the bit there, so go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to say that we also, since I've been here, we now have a relationship with the Create Lab at Carnegie Mellon. So we're teaching our pre-service teachers how to use the kinds of innovative computing and robotics that they're developing so that our students take these out into the schools to get them excited. But even more importantly, exactly what Bart and Billy have said, we all know that we learn best when we're excited and interested. You know, we'll investigate things if we're curious. So that's what we're trying to make sure our teacher candidates know when they leave us, is that that's the spark that they have to find in each and every child. What interests them, and how do we wrap learning into that, around it, up and down? And I agree, Bart, you know, if we have to stand on our head to get them involved, then by golly, we ought to do that.
All right, and the last question here, and at the end of the day, we know people are concerned about results. Certainly the parents are. The kids, for the most part, they want to get good grades, and everybody seems to be concerned about the test results. So how do you weigh the sparking of the creativity with what is expected? Test scores, graduation rates, or if kids are engaged and involved and learning, will the scores just take care of themselves?
We have to be intentional about test-taking strategies and helping students to achieve on all tests, no matter what they might be, whether they're SAT tests or advanced placement scores or state standardized testing. But the fact of the matter is innovation has to be intentional. It's intentional. It's about processes. It's about human design thinking. And it's about incorporating all of these so that our students have the fortitude and the ability to be able to answer the questions on the standardized test and that they have use those skills, whether they be mathematical skills and measuring or whatever it might be, that they're able to answer those questions when the questions are posed to them.
And I agree, Billy. I think it's really critical that we certainly have to be concerned about what children need to know. But the other thing that's really concerns to me relative to that, Paul, is that the equity in public education, that we have a lot of communities where the kids really just don't have the resources to use some of these technologies to help them learn, and then that gap is growing, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to find ways to integrate that technology. I think out of Tucson, when you guys were out of Arizona, 85% free reduced lunch, and every they passed out 15,000 iPads to kids or computers to children, and it's made a tremendous impact in that learning in the school. But again, they're doing it in an area where I don't think they're worried about the test results so much. I think they're trying to level the playing field for those kids, Paul, and I think that's really what is powerful for me, and obviously what I try to do. I care deeply about every child, and hoping that you know, just putting that technology in the hands, it's going to turn that light on, and they're going to be able to do some creative things and hopefully solve the numerous problems that exist in this world.
Lynn, we'll let you have the last word.
Excellent. I couldn't agree more. Explicating how what they're learning is important, to go back to the test, to answer the question, to use the calculator, you still have to know whether you're going to multiply or divide, which button to push. So they're the basics that we want our kids to know, but then challenging them, the test results are going to take care of themselves, and hopefully then the students will be able to help us in the future to recognize what's really important is powerful citizens of this country and the world.
Our guests have been Billy Rondinelli, superintendent of the South Fayette School District, also Bart Rocco, superintendent of the Elizabeth Forward School District, and Dr. Lynn Shrum, Dean of West Virginia University's College of Education and Human Services and co-chair of the Remake Learning Council. Thanks to all of you for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thank you for listening.